Good afternoon. It's Mountain Edition. I'm Wyatt Orm.
And I'm Allison Bektesh. The new administration is causing some introspection at this year's Aspen Ideas Festival.
Changes in Garfield County meant to allow for tiny homes might only have a tiny impact.
We will talk with a humor expert about what makes things funny.
And local skiers will have the chance to enjoy the foot of snow that fell on Ajax last week after all.
Those stories and more coming up on Mountain Edition.
The first phase of the plan to rip up and replace Aspen's pedestrian malls is nearly complete.
Tonight, the Aspen City Council will hear a summary of public feedback regarding an overhaul to the Hyman and Cooper Avenue walking malls. The input was gathered during multiple open houses over the last 6 months and will be used as the foundation for the next four phases of the project. Throughout this month, there have also been a series of holes drilled under the mall to gauge the state of the aging infrastructure. After council direction this evening, phase two will begin. Three conceptual designs for the updated promenade should be complete by fall. Allison Bektesh, Aspen Public Radio News.
The Aspen Skiing Company announced on Monday that skiers will get to enjoy last week's winter storm. As Elizabeth Stewart Severy reports, Aspen Mountain will reopen for Memorial Day weekend.
SkiCo will open 130 acres of mostly intermediate terrain on the upper mountain to skiers and riders for the three-day weekend. A storm last week dropped 18 inches of snow at the resort. The gondola will run from 10 to 4, and Ajax Express is set to be open from 10 to 2. The holiday weekend also marks the start of summer sightseeing at Ajax. The gondola will run from 10 to 4 the next three weekends before opening daily in mid-June. Elizabeth Stewart Severy, Aspen Public Radio News.
On Monday, U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions narrowed the definition of sanctuary jurisdictions. They are now places that willfully refuse to comply with federal immigration laws. Picken County is one of them.
Picken County Sheriff Joe DeSalvo was recently contacted by ICE, the Federal Immigration Agency. They're cutting his federal funding. DeSalvo says the county is being singled out because his office has taken a public stance on not complying with ICE up to a point. If ICE wants him to keep someone in his jail, he'll only do so if there's a judicially reviewed warrant. It's the same position all counties in Colorado have taken, citing constitutional violations.
A bill that would have allowed people on a mental health hold to stay longer in hospitals or jails was vetoed by Governor John Hickenlooper. Wyatt spoke with producer Kristen Kay about how the veto highlights the lack of psychiatric care in our valley.
So Wyatt, let's just get some terms straight. The issue at hand is an M1 hold. What is that?
So an M1 hold is basically where someone, due to a mental illness, is a risk to themselves or to others. And it's only a licensed clinician, a police officer, or a medical doctor who can make this determination. And it basically says, you know, this person needs treatment. So in June of last year, Governor Hickenlooper vetoed a bill that would have allowed people on M1 holds to stay longer in the emergency room or in the jail.
Why did he veto the bill?
Because of civil liberties, he basically said having a mental illness is not a crime. People with mental illnesses, especially those suffering from an episode, they need therapy. So sticking them in the jail could just make the problem worse. Some rural counties might not have anywhere else to put someone who's suffering in this way, but the state has sort of said, too bad.
Is that happening locally? Are people with mental illnesses ending up in jails?
It's not happening now. I spoke with an official from Picken County, as well as a person from Mine Springs. In Garfield County, Eagle, and Picken counties, none of the jails do this. None of the jails keep M1 holds in the jail if they haven't committed a crime. So instead, they go to emergency rooms where they can only stay for 72 hours legally. And so the question then is, where do they go after that, after those 72 hours?
So where do they go?
If a clinician thinks that the M1 designation still applies, then they need to go to a psychiatric hospital. And Colorado has an extreme shortage of psychiatric beds. And this is something that does impact our valley. I mean, Valley View Hospital in Grand Junction might do anywhere between 100 or 200 transfers in a given year. That's transfers of M1 patients to a psychiatric hospital. And this means that the hospital is driving people to hospitals all around the state.
Do we have any plans to address the shortage of beds?
So first off, West Springs Hospital in Grand Junction is planning an expansion. They're trying to double the number of beds that they currently have now. So they're raising money. They're trying to get to a total of 64 beds. They're trying to raise about $18 million. They've raised 10. Pitkin County and Garfield County have both promised $50,000. Eagle County has made an initial contribution of $10,000. There is something called the Facility Placement Agreement, which is not allowed now. I spoke with a representative of MindSprings who is hoping that this will become a reality in the future, where basically a place like MindSprings that has the license to administer care to mental health patients would collaborate with a hospital and basically train the staff, help do the court legwork, and basically work alongside a hospital in order to allow M1 holds to stay at the hospital for longer than the 72 hours. So there are some plans in the works, but there's still a massive shortage of psychiatric beds.
To listen to more extended conversations with our news team about current Roaring Fork Valley issues, subscribe to Aspen Public Radio's new podcast, The Dial. Go to aspenpublicradio.org. Under the Your News tab, click on The Dial.
This is Mountain Edition on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Wyatt Orme. Stay in the know with what's happening in the Roaring Fork Valley and beyond through our social media channels. Follow Aspen Pub Radio on Twitter, follow us on Instagram, and like us on Facebook for your up-to-the-minute news updates, compelling images, and intriguing stories. Aspen Public Radio, your news, your music, your station. The Roaring Fork is on Colorado's list of impaired rivers, and City of Aspen officials have been working for over a decade to keep stormwater runoff out of the river in order to improve its health. Environment reporter Elizabeth Stewart-Severy spoke with Kristen Kay about the issue.
Elizabeth, a few weeks ago, you and I talked about how this plan will focus on addressing low flows in the river, but you also mentioned that stormwater runoff is a top concern for river health.
Yeah, so since 2006, there have been several major projects to improve the river that have cost millions of dollars. Basically, the city directs stormwater from the streets through underground vaults, which are designed to slow the water down so debris and pollution sink. When the water resurfaces, it passes through constructed wetlands or sandbars that act as natural filters. So there are several of these projects around town.
Where are those projects?
Well, the most recent one is at Proctor Open Space near Heron Park, and that's supposed to wrap up this summer. And the city also fairly recently finished a major project at Rio Grande Park. So these are some of the larger projects that address some of the biggest outfalls in town. So, for example, the stormwater features at Rio Grande Park are designed to treat all the water that drains from the downtown core with all the restaurants and, you know, most of the dirtiest stuff in Aspen before it gets into the Roaring Fork River.
And do these work?
Yeah, they do. So April Long, who heads up the city's work on stormwater and the Clean River program, told me that water that comes out of these treatment areas is about 90 to 98% clean from pollutants. So it's cleaner than the river itself. But they're expensive, and April says that the city doesn't have the money to build the treatment areas everywhere that they're needed.
What are some of the areas that aren't being treated?
So there are at least three major outfalls in town that could use better stormwater treatment. On the east side of town, April says they need to treat water coming off of Highway 82 near the Cooper Avenue Bridge. And then another drainage comes in near the old art museum where Gibson and Mill Street and Red Mountain Road all meet. And the city is actually in the conceptual design phase for a new project there. And then also at either Maroon or Castle Creek, though April says both of those need further study before they decide where to go.
Are there plans to put any of those projects in place?
So not really yet. And April says that funding is a concern. When the program started, it was funded about half from a mill levy on property taxes and then also from a significant fee on developers. But then the recession hit a few years later and council removed that fee on development. So the Clean River Program has identified some major projects along with smaller things like rain gardens around town that act as smaller filters. And the mill levy is still in place, so these projects are likely to happen eventually, but April says if the funding structure doesn't change, it could take many more years to see progress.
Interesting. The Roaring Fork River through Aspen is listed as impaired, and Aspen city officials are developing a plan to improve its health. They are asking for community feedback through the end of the month. Elizabeth, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Last week, Aspen Words announced the schedule for its public events for this summer. Claire Woodcock has the details.
The Aspen Summer Words Writing Conference and Literary Festival begins next month. Programming includes juried and non-juried writing workshops, networking opportunities with publishing agents and editors, and a reader's retreat. Afternoon author panels, there are three total, will take place at the Gant. Evening events hosted at the Belly Up will also include Literature with Impact and Living the Creative Life. The annual summer benefit on June 21st will feature Margot Lee Shetterly, author of the novel Hidden Figures, at the Hotel Jerome. The Summer Word Series kicks off June 18th. Claire Woodcock, Edless Neeson Arts and Culture Desk.
A plan to widen the sidewalk on Castle Creek Bridge is on hold, Elizabeth Stewart Severy reports.
Last summer's Living Lab project was well received by pedestrians and cyclists, but the city of Aspen did not receive any qualified bids to build a permanent version. According to Pete Rice with the city's engineering department, contractors are concerned that construction of the Grand Avenue Bridge in Glenwood and the underpass in Basalt would make it difficult to get crews in to complete the work this summer. Tonight, City Council is expected to discuss a temporary fix for this summer, but that would come with a hefty price tag. The city plans to put the project back out to bid late this summer, with construction possible next spring. Elizabeth Stewart Severy, Aspen Public Radio Environment Desk.
The numbers are in on how the Aspen Snowmass Resort did this past winter season, and it wasn't too bad, despite lackluster snowfall. News director Carolyn Zachariasen covers the ski industry and broke down the numbers with producer Kristen Kay.
So, Carolyn, how did the past 6 months shake out?
Well, we ended on both high and low notes. It was the best season Aspen has seen in a decade, but April saw a double-digit decline over last year. We came out slightly better than the 2015-16 season by 0.2%. That's because December, January, and March were behemoth months for occupancy.
Why was April such a bust and the others so successful?
Well, I spoke with Bill Tomsich. He heads up our Central Reservations Agency, Stay Aspen Snowmass. He characterized April as being hit with a, quote, triple whammy. The weather was warm, so last-minute bookings didn't come in. Number two, one of the largest groups, the Disabled American Veterans, held its gathering in March instead of last month, like it usually does. And three, the airline suspended most of their flights in anticipation of the off-season. Luckily, bookings for the second half of December, along with all of January and March, were solid. Tomsich points to what is now being called the, quote, storm that saved Christmas, along with the X Games, a busier gay ski week, record snowfall, and then the World Cup finals in March for occupancy success. He also said Australian business made a comeback. Those months allowed us to surpass our competitors throughout the West. Destometrics, which is a company that tracks reservation data, reported last week that Western Mountain Resorts experienced their first seasonal decline in winter occupancy since the 2011-12 season.
Interesting. So what was our overall occupancy for the 2016-17 winter season?
So this is what's so crazy. Just under 60% for both Aspen and Snowmass.
Huh.
So when the community conversation becomes an argument for the resort needing more hotel rooms, it's hard to justify when we are just slightly over the halfway mark. Tomsich says this topic was part of a spirited discussion at the Chamber of Commerce board meeting last month. Some suggested we need to focus on getting to the 80% mark year-round. The mayor brought up concerns about the town's carrying capacity. it can only handle so many people. Tomsich did note that nearly every weekend between mid-December and March, occupancy is nearly at 100%. And same with parts of the summer and even into the fall. And that is one strong argument for more hotels.
So how does that affect the cost of hotel rooms?
That demand-supply equation does drive up room rates. Some boast our average daily room rate keeps breaking records. During high season, it costs more than $800 a night for a room in Aspen, and in Snowmass, it's $600.
It's unbelievable.
Right, so those are just averages. I mean, that's the lowest, most likely. On the positive side, it's those prices that help keep hotels open when they may only have a few people staying at their properties, you know, when it's slower during the shoulder seasons.
So it all balances out over the year.
Right. For the hotel, you know, they need that revenue with the high room rate to cover, like a lot of business models for people who live in a cyclical economy where it's seasonal like that.
Mm-hmm. So how does the summer look?
Tomsich says June is nearly sold out, and that's not surprising since that month hosts Food and Wine and Jazz Aspen, Snowmass, and Our Day, and most of the Ideas Festival falls in June this year. He said that July bookings are pacing behind last year, but he's not too concerned about that. What isn't pacing behind last year are the numbers of flights being offered. Tomsich says Sardi Field has an unprecedented balance of, quote, competition, connection, and capacity. So all told, this summer, we will have three airlines providing nonstop flights to seven cities. So that's between 24 and 35 flights a day. And just as a footnote for winter, because Tomsich also is the liaison for our airline industry, there will be three airlines providing nonstop service to 10 cities in and out of Aspen.
Wow. Busy time at the airport.
Right.
Thanks, Carolyn.
My pleasure.
The need for affordable housing has spurred some changes in Garfield County. Recently, the commissioners changed the building code to allow for tiny homes, which are minimalistic and a fraction of the average home size. Wyatt looked into how much change the county really brought about.
Bill Nesman's tiny home has Dutch double doors. Those are the kind where the top can swing out while the bottom stays put. He thinks it's a clever design.
Tiny houses are small, so the more that you can let the inside out and the outside in, it really adds to the space.
Nesman lives with his wife and son up 4 Mile Road on the way to Sunlight. His tiny home is on a trailer that's parked behind their main home. He and a friend built it over the course of 3 months. Nesman was going for rustic. The exterior is all reclaimed barnwood. The roof is corrugated steel. Inside, river rock tiles cover the bathroom floor.
I didn't want to use like any plastics or any fake countertops or anything like that because that wouldn't have been in an old farmhouse. I really want it to feel like you're in an old farmhouse.
The whole space is 250 square feet, but it feels roomy. This is a queen size bed up here? Wow.
And I really wanted it being...
Before April 1st of this year, no home in Garfield County could be smaller than 20 feet by 20 feet. The commissioners decided to scratch this. They also changed what's significant only to those creating the smallest possible space, like allowing a ladder to substitute for a staircase to climb into a loft. Changes like these should give Nesman more leeway. He rents property for a living and built the tiny home to rent it out. You think a tiny home is a quirky vacation rental? It gets quirkier. You have a treehouse on Airbnb?
I do. Yep.
He parked his tiny home in November and listed it on Airbnb in the first week of April. It was book solid before he knew.
Something like this easily can generate $2,000 to $3,000 a month in income. And I think that shocks a lot of people that don't know.
Why, then, is Nesman getting rid of his tiny home?
So my covenants doesn't allow two dwellings on the same property.
The neighborhood rules say no one can be living in it or even staying overnight in it. It's on wheels, so it's technically a mobile home. Nesman could apply for a land use permit with the county. They get these requests all the time. He'd have to take the home off its wheels and put it on a foundation, but he'd still come up against the neighborhood's rules. So he's selling it for $47,000.
And literally, I probably get 10 phone calls a day, people asking about it, inquiring about it.
A few have made offers in the low 40s, but most don't have the money up front. Getting a loan for a tiny home isn't really a thing yet, so many ask him to owner finance. Scratch the surface here and you come to a bigger problem.
The biggest problem people are having is finding a space to be able to put it full time.
If you own land, great. You can also put a tiny home on property zoned as multifamily. Too bad most of Garfield County is zoned as single family. This is why some say Garfield County isn't doing enough for the tiny home movement here. Jeff Nally is the owner of Out West Tiny Homes in Newcastle. He dreams of building a tiny home subdivision. He once saw one in Alabama and thought it could work here.
Have all utilities through it, have roads, have parking.
Except everything would be smaller.
We're definitely going to try to keep it in the $40,000 to $45,000 range.
$40,000 to $45,000 for a little house on a little piece of property. The county's 20 by 20 requirement halted Nally's project. Even with the recent changes, Nally says it still doesn't make sense to move forward. A certain number of the homes would need to be wheelchair accessible as per ADA requirements, and the lofts need to have what's called an egress window for fire safety. Nally understands these requirements, but his bottom line is his bottom line.
I mean, you're still in the 600 square foot range right now, 700 square foot range right now.
Meaning Nally would be building homes that aren't tiny enough to be profitable. Nally and Nessman share the same frustration.
Right now, it's dysfunctional. It doesn't work.
But they both say,
times change, environments change, laws change.
How and when this happens will be another story.
You're listening to Mountain Edition from Aspen Public Radio News. I'm Allison Bechtesh. If you missed the first part of today's show, you can find a podcast on our website, aspenpublicradio.org. While you're browsing our site, make sure to sign up for ForkFed, our weekly digital newsletter. ForkFed arrives in your inbox every Friday, catching you up on the week's news in a fun and informative way.
Representatives from 27 Colorado communities took a pledge last week in Aspen. As Elizabeth Stewart Severy reports, the goal is to act aggressively on climate change.
Aspen Mayor Steve Skadron and City Climate Action Manager Ashley Pearl launched the Compact of Colorado Communities during an event last week. Elected officials from 22 cities and 5 counties in Colorado agreed to present the charter for the new organization to their local governing bodies. The compact would then be a network for training leaders to address climate issues, share information, and prioritize action. Locally, Snowmass Village, Basalt, Carbondale, and Glenwood Springs, as well as Pitkin and Eagle counties, are on board. Garfield County did not attend. Elizabeth Stewart Severy, Aspen Public Radio Environment Desk.
Each summer, world leaders and innovative thinkers gather in Aspen for the Aspen Ideas Festival. Allison spoke with Kristen Kay about what we can expect this year. They started by discussing how the current political climate and the Trump administration is affecting the lineup.
It is very interesting. Of course, this is the first time in 8 years we have a new administration. Only 4 tracks are going to last through the entirety of the festival, and they have titles such as Making It in the USA, The America I Know, and The Art of Change, which is described this way. Artists play a powerful role in shaping our views of who we are as a country. The Aspen Institute clearly believes that this year is a time for some navel-gazing, time for a little national analysis, and I think that speaks closely to the fact that we have a new administration.
And so who are some of the speakers for these topics? Who is generating some buzz this year?
The full festival agenda is released about a week prior to the festival, so we don't know those biggest big names yet, and no one close to the Trump administration has been announced. There are some usual suspects who have already been announced, and I think will make for some very interesting conversation, including Sally Yates, who was technically a part of the Trump administration cabinet for a few days as the United States Deputy Attorney General, but was fired by the president. Former CIA Director David Petraeus, New Jersey Senator Cory Booker, who was on the shortlist for Hillary's VP picks, and our own Governor Hickenlooper. Representing the American Artist track are Jeff Koons, documentary filmmaker Ken Burns, writer Susan Orlean, and the most American TV producer of all time, Norman Lear. We'll see what he thinks of our current state of affairs.
What else is going on around the festival this year?
So it always starts out with Spotlight Health. That's 3 days focused entirely on medical practices, health research, global health, Aspen Public Radio partners with them. We've actually had a chance to speak with some of those presenters. They're fascinating. Those interviews are online now, aspenpublicradio.org. And then there's always events in town that are more open to the public. Even if you were an absolute billionaire, all the tickets are sold out to the Aspen Ideas Festival proper at this point. So those public events are the last chance for access to some of these speakers. Those public tickets go on sale on June 16th. This year, there's also a program for young professionals, a very limited number of cheap passes that will get you into all of those events. So the Aspen Institute is trying to make it a little more accessible. I think our listeners will be most excited about how much radio-specific stuff there is out there. Jon Favreau is the co-host of Pod Save America. He's the former director of speech writing for President Barack Obama. He'll be taping his podcast in town. And then there'll be many other well-known NPR names, including Steve Inskeep and Michelle Norris here in town.
Just so exciting for radio dorks like us.
It's going to be great.
This year's Aspen Ideas Festival will run from June 22nd to July 1st. Thanks, Allison.
It's my pleasure.
Dr. Peter McGraw is a professor in the business department at the University of Colorado at Boulder. His most recent research examines what makes things funny. Claire Woodcock spoke with him about the big secret behind humor.
So in 2014, you published this book called The Humor Code, A Global Search for What Makes Things Funny, where you and Denver journalist Joel Werner traveled the globe in search of humor. What did you find out?
The thing is, what didn't we find out? The way we structured the travels was to answer a particular question in each place that we went. So basically, each of the chapters looked at a different question, then, you know, we try to draw a conclusion based upon our experience there.
Is this how you became an expert on the subject of humor?
You know, to be honest, at the time that I kind of stumbled on the question of what makes things funny, you know, I had claimed to be an emotions researcher, but I had never considered the question. I didn't know how to answer the question. The quick story is that I was giving a talk on what makes things wrong. I was giving a talk about moral violations. So I started working on an answer to that particular question. Why do we laugh at moral violations? And then it very quickly blossomed, I guess, you know, into something that consumes much of my research life now, 8 years later.
So do you have a grasp on what the big secret is behind being funny?
Thankfully, I do. Scholars have been contemplating this question for 2,500 years back to Greek philosophy. The problem, though, is that they didn't have at their disposal what modern scholars have, which is the ability to do experiments. And so the experiments that we've done has provided a great deal of support for what we call the benign violation theory. In short, we tend to laugh at, or we tend to be amused by, things that are wrong yet okay, things that are threatening yet safe, things that are confusing yet make sense. So they have both a kind of negative and positive element to it. So this negative element we call a violation, that things aren't the way they ought to be. But on the other hand, that thing that is wrong is okay. And we laugh to signal to others that this violation is benign.
That was Dr. Peter McGraw, a marketing professor at CU Boulder who researches humor and human behavior. I'm Claire Woodcock at the Edlis Neeson Arts and Culture Desk.
That's all for this week's Mountain Edition. I'm Allison Bektesh.
And I'm Wyatt Orm. To hear this show again or subscribe to our Mountain Edition podcast, head to our website, aspenpublicradio.org.
Tune in tomorrow at 3:30 for Valley Roundup. News director Carolyn Sakariasen talks with a panel of local journalists about the week's news.
Thanks for listening. Mountain Edition is a production of Aspen Public Radio News.